In the summer of 1966, Bobby Fuller was a rising star. Along with his band, the Bobby Fuller Four, they were riding the wave of success after a series of tour dates, television appearances, and hit singles, including the well-known I Fought the Law. However, there was some inner turmoil amongst the band. Rumors at the time suggested Bobby was unhappy with their record contract, had questions about where some of the money was going, and was angry when he discovered their songs were being adjusted without his approval. Bobby began talking about leaving the band, and a meeting was arranged with their producer. Bobby, though, wouldn't make it to that meeting. After leaving his apartment in the early morning hours of July 18th, Bobby would be found dead under very bizarre circumstances. He would be found in his car, lying across the front seat, with his entire body soaked in gasoline. Ultimately, his death would be ruled a suicide, against the arguments of friends and family. The LAPD would seemingly agree without investigating, destroying evidence without ever processing it. Would Bobby Fuller have taken his own life under such strange circumstances at the peak of his stardom when he was in the middle of planning his solo career, or was someone else in his car that fateful day? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 87, The Mysterious Death of Bobby Fuller. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine one of the most enduring mysteries in the history of the music business, the death of Bobby Fuller. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at TraceEvPod, on Instagram at TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today, we look into the bizarre circumstances surrounding the death of a 23-year-old musician who had the world in the palm of his hand and then lost everything in the blink of an eye. This is Episode 87, The Mysterious Death of Bobby Fuller. Robert Gaston Fuller, commonly called Bobby, was born on October 22, 1942 in Goose Creek, Texas. Goose Creek would later become Baytown. Robert was the first shared child for parents Lawson and Eva Lorraine, though Lorraine had a son from a previous marriage, Doris Franklin LaFleur, though everyone called him Jack. Jack was 12 at the time and very excited to have a new younger brother, and he would celebrate again 2 years later when the Fullers welcomed their last son, Randy, in 1944. While there was a huge age gap between Jack and his two younger brothers, the siblings were close, and Jack would often act as a makeshift babysitter for his brothers. Life wasn't exactly easy for the Fuller family, with several moves, as Lawson, working in the oil industry, sought better work to provide a more comfortable life for his family. Just a few years into Bobby's young life, the family up and moved 1,500 miles to the northwest, settling in Salt Lake City. It would be in Utah that Bobby would spend the majority of his younger years. Bobby was a fun-loving, excitable child who enjoyed laughing and singing. From a young age, Bobby was drawn to the radio and found himself pretending to play along to the music of the late 1940s and early 1950s. While Bobby and Randy formed a tight bond and were typically well-behaved, Jack was a little more rowdy and would often stir up trouble. Usually, if Bobby and Randy found themselves in a tight spot, Jack had helped work them into it. Jack's life would be marked by several troubling situations, and by the time he was in his teens, his relationship with his younger brothers was deteriorating. Jack was beginning to go his own way. Bobby and Randy were never tighter. And as Randy began growing, he caught up with Bobby, and the two looked so similar that people often asked if they were twins. Bobby began developing his musical interests when he began learning to play piano at age 5. In an article for the El Paso Times, Lorraine, when asked about her son's affinity for music, responded, quote, "He was always interested in music. I never discouraged him, but I didn't give him the idea either. I don't know where his obsession with music came from. It seemed to be his only interest. We just accepted it early that he would always be involved in music." End quote. Music had become the main focus of Bobby's life. He started taking music classes, where he excelled, and began learning his way around several different instruments, including the drums, which would be his focus for the next few years. Influenced early on by jazz, Bobby would play drums in several public events and even began working towards forming his own band. Jazz was extremely popular in Salt Lake City at the time, but when Bobby was 13 years old, his family moved back to Texas, settling in El Paso. Bobby's father had found a job working for a gas company, and this would enable him to provide a more stable and settled home life for his family. 1956, the year of their move, would be a major turning point in Bobby's life, as it was the year that Elvis Presley exploded onto the music scene with a series of appearances on television. While Elvis may have been an early influence on Bobby, it was Buddy Holly that would become his musical idol. Holly, a fellow Texan, would break into the mainstream in 1957, and once Bobby heard his music on the radio, he would become focused on that sound and style. Now, in high school, Bobby continued playing drums and was in the school band, but school wasn't all it was cracked up to be. Bobby's focus was not on academics, and he was vastly more interested in his part-time job at a local music store. There were few interests that could grab Bobby's attention like music, though cars and girls were gaining favor in his mind. Bobby was reportedly the kind of guy who could walk into a room and have girls swooning, and he often spent weekends drag racing around local back roads. Perhaps influenced lightly by his half-brother, Bobby also gained a reputation for causing trouble. But whereas Jack was frequently caught in the act, Bobby was more likely to use his charm and charisma to talk his way out of trouble, or to not get caught in the first place. One example might be Bobby's interest in seeing live performances. He wasn't old enough to gain entrance to local bars and clubs, but he soon found out about a bar where they didn't care much how old their patrons were, and he would frequently sneak out late at night to attend shows, and sometimes he'd even step onto the stage and perform with the bands. By the time Bobby was 16, he came up with a plan to create his own personal recording studio. He had a talent for sound engineering and frequently spent hours in the library reading about the ins and outs of studio construction. Armed with that knowledge and his apparent innate ability to perform, he was able to wire up the sound system himself. The studio was constructed in the garage of the family home, located on the aptly named Album Avenue. Bobby would record there many times and would even bring in others to record their projects in his studio. Before Bobby ever released an album, he earned a reputation throughout the area as being a gifted musician with a mastery of drums and an ever-growing talent on guitar. As the 1950s came to a close, Bobby was primarily focused on mastering that guitar. One of the earliest iterations of what would eventually become the Bobby Fuller Four was a band titled Captain Fuller and the Rocket Squad. Initially, Randy was meant to be the guitarist, but when Bobby took up the instrument, Randy had to pivot, learning to play bass instead. Together, the brothers began recording more complicated songs in their home studio. When Bobby became a senior in high school, he entertained the idea of college. But those who knew Bobby knew that his dream of being a musician was unlikely to be placed on hold to earn a degree. Unfortunately, Bobby's senior year would be marked by a family tragedy. Bobby's older half-brother, Jack, had returned to Texas after a nomadic existence which kept him distant from his family. Having newly earned a license as a barber, Jack was working in El Paso when he struck up a friendship with Roy Leon Handy. Jack and Roy got along well. Both were divorced, single, and looking for something more out of life. The exact details of what led to the tragedy aren't exactly confirmed, with various stories leading in different directions. Some rumors suggest that Jack and Roy had purchased a treasure map that alleged to lead to buried gold somewhere in New Mexico. In other accounts, Jack and Roy had an affinity for firearms and had been driving into the New Mexico desert to set up targets and fire off shots. What cannot be argued, though, is that on February 4, 1961, Roy produced a .22 caliber pistol and fired three shots, hitting Jack in the arm, back, and back of the head. Police reports state that the shots were fired from close range and that Jack was robbed following the shooting, at which time Roy drove off in Jack's 57 Chevy. On February 8th, Jack's stepfather filed a missing persons report. Roy had disposed of the murder weapon, but was in possession of Jack's identification and had gone around various Texas towns passing forged checks and pretending to be Jack. When he was arrested in Lubbock, Texas on February 21st, Roy confessed to the murder and led authorities to the location of Jack's body. Roy would later be sentenced to life imprisonment, but issues with the investigation and errors in the reporting resulted in his sentence being reduced to a mere 10 years for the charge of manslaughter. Roy would move away from Texas years later, continuing on with his life, while Jack was buried next to his biological father in Haskell, Texas. It was a difficult time for Lorraine to lose her firstborn son, but sadly, this would not be the last time she'd have to bury one of her own children. Some believe that Jack's death had a dramatic impact on Bobby's life, perhaps for the first time eliminating that teenage sense of immortality. In what can only be described as an almost prophetic sense of a short life, Bobby became intensely focused on not only developing a musical career, but crafting a legacy that would live on beyond his own years. While Bobby had begun playing shows at local clubs, he made the shrewd decision to open his own club. This would afford him the ability to play to the crowd whenever he wanted, while also making money on admission, which was $2 at the time. Perhaps due to his own struggles as a young teen trying to get in to see bands, Bobby designed his club, called Rendezvous, as a teen club. Alcohol would not be served, and teens could attend, see live performances, and not have to deal with the rougher crowd that often frequented local area drinking establishments. The club was a major hit, drawing in larger crowds every week. Bobby began making good money, providing him the ability to obtain better equipment and the possibility of recording in a real studio. While the club was extremely successful, Bobby was struggling with his band. He worked hard on his music, trying to master every instrument he put his hands on, and while his bandmates also loved music, they may not have been as intensely devoted as he was. If Bobby felt someone wasn't playing to their best ability, or perhaps that their best ability wasn't good enough, he had no problem rotating them out of the band, and this would happen multiple times in the early years. The only consistent member of the band was his brother Randy. In 1961, Bobby released his first single, entitled You're in Love. Over the next few years, he would release more singles, some recorded in professional studios, others in his home studio. Bobby's first major hit, though, would come as the result of a strange influence. Buddy Holly had tragically lost his life in a 1959 plane crash, which also took the lives of Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper. Buddy's band, the Crickets, were still around and had brought in Sonny Curtis to work as their new lead singer, taking the place of Holly, a fairly difficult task. In 1958, Curtis had written the song I Fought the Law, which he later recorded with the Crickets. The song would be covered several times, but it would be Bobby's 1964 version that would hit regional airwaves and open the door to future success. That same year, Bobby and his band would move to Los Angeles, signing a deal with Mustang Records. This version of the band would see Bobby as lead guitarist and singer, Randy on bass, Dwayne Chirico on drums, and Jim Reese on rhythm guitar. Bob Keane, the owner of Delphi Records, had worked with Ritchie Valens prior to his untimely death, and decided to take a chance on Bobby. Their initial project involved a release on Keane's Donna Records label when the band was referred to as Bobby Fuller and the Fanatics, which would eventually become the Bobby Fuller Four. By this time, the Beatles were a major influence on the American music scene, and while many bands were trying to fashion themselves after the foursome, Bobby wasn't interested in going that way. He remained tied to his roots, his love for Buddy Holly and their style, and so the Bobby Fuller Four set out on Mustang Records to carve out their place in history. Reportedly, in one of their first meetings after signing with Mustang, the band was told they'd be on the top of the charts within a year. While much of the band saw that as a dream, Bobby viewed it as an absolute reality, and he was right. In 1966, Mustang Records re-released I Fought the Law, which Bobby had re-recorded, altering some of the lyrics, but with the same instrumental. This time, the song broke out of the regional success it had previously earned, going on the national airwaves and being played at radio stations all around the country. In March of 66, the single hit the top 10 in the United States. The success of I Fought the Law was followed up with the release of Love's Made a Fool of You, another song not written by the band, but by Buddy Holly himself. In what can only be described as a sign of the times, Bobby and the band appeared in the 1966 film The Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, starring Nancy Sinatra and Boris Karloff. In the film, Bobby and the band lip-synced songs by a different band, and while it wasn't exactly what Bobby wanted, it did get his actual band more exposure. By the summer of 66, the Bobby Fuller Four were everywhere. They were making national television appearances and performing major Los Angeles clubs, such as the Whiskey A Go-Go. While everything seemed to be going exactly the way Bobby had dreamed, there were whispers behind the scenes that the charismatic performer was not only unhappy with the band, but with the business arrangements they'd made. According to Miriam Lena's 2015 book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller, Bob Keane had cut a distribution deal with Roulette Records. At the time, the music industry was heavily impacted by the involvement of organized crime. The record company's founder included notorious figure Morris Levy, a known mobster. AllMusic, previously AllMusic Guide, once described Levy as, quote, a notorious crook who swindled artists out of their owed royalties. Levy was known to have done business with the DeCavalcante, Gambino, and Genovese crime families. In addition to contract issues, Bobby felt that producer Bob Keane was altering his music without his approval. On multiple tracks, Bobby heard melodies and string accompaniment added to songs that he did not approve of. Bobby also felt that Keane was attempting to sow seeds of discord by pushing him towards a solo career as a pop singer. And while Bobby had dreams of going solo, he wasn't interested in being a pop star. It was around this time, in the midsummer of 66, that Bobby began speaking openly about his unhappiness with the current situation and desire to back out of everything, walk away from the fame and stardom, return home to El Paso, where he'd continue to build more clubs, as well as using his established name to possibly construct his own record label from which he could record in the way he wanted. In what may have been a final straw for Bobby, Keane canceled a European tour for the band, which Bobby had been looking forward to. Their music was climbing the charts in the UK, and Bobby saw the possibility of further expansion, but Keane apparently had different ideas. At that time, Bobby told several friends and bandmates that he planned to walk away from the band and his recording contract. He wanted out. He wanted to be in charge of his own career, and he didn't want to associate with Bob Keane or his record label. Perhaps in an attempt to smooth things over or to discuss the future of the band, a meeting was set up to take place at Bob Keane's office on the morning of Monday, July 18th, but Bobby would never make it to that meeting. On Sunday, July 17th, Bobby spent most of his time relaxing with friends who were visiting from El Paso. During this time, the band had been run ragged, performing shows, making television appearances, doing promotional work on radio shows and various interviews. A day off was rare, and so when they were given a week off starting July 10th, everyone planned to take advantage of the time by doing as little as possible. Bobby, not a heavy drinker or drug user, did enjoy spending time with friends, throwing back a few cold beers, and maybe smoking a joint here and there, spent most of that Sunday with his pals laughing about the old days and just unwinding. He knew there was the meeting the next day, and they were supposed to rehearse in studio as well, and so he was tired and trying to take advantage of every opportunity he had to just sit back and avoid the stress. He knew the meeting wasn't going to go well, especially once he told Keane his plans. On Sunday evening, Bobby was back at his apartment, located on Sycamore Street in Hollywood, where his mother was staying, having arrived in town a few days earlier to visit her sons. In addition to Lorraine, the band's road manager and one of Bobby's good friends, Rick Stone, was also staying at the apartment. According to Stone, he was hanging out on the couch watching television and drinking beer while Bobby made several phone calls. Stone reported falling asleep in front of the television sometime around midnight, while Lorraine herself says she spoke to Bobby for the last time just before she went to bed around 1 a.m. Lorraine would later tell Edna Gunderson of the El Paso Times, quote, "He was wide awake. He always stayed up playing his guitar and listening to records. I told him good night. That was the last time I saw him alive. Later, I heard him leave the apartment. It didn't disturb me. I don't know why he went out, but I think he probably went to get something to eat. He often did that." End quote. According to friends and family, Bobby was very much of a night owl and rarely went to sleep before sunrise. The last person to confirm seeing Bobby was an employee of the apartment complex who said he shared a beer with the singer at approximately 3 a.m. By all reports, everyone who saw Bobby that Sunday said he was in good spirits, feeling positive, and making plans for the future. Early on the morning of July 18th, both Rick Stone and Lorraine noticed that Bobby had not returned to the apartment. In addition to Lorraine, Rick had also heard the sound of the apartment door opening then closing during the night and assumed that it was Bobby going out for a nightcap. Bobby's failure to return home wasn't an immediate cause for alarm, and both Rick and Lorraine made note of the fact that Lorraine's blue Oldsmobile was gone as well, and so it was assumed that Bobby had gone out and possibly spent the night at a friend's house. Rick proceeded down to the studio where the band was scheduled to rehearse, but Bobby never arrived. This was surprising to everyone, including Randy, as it was highly unlike Bobby to miss an appointment, especially without notifying anyone. Later that afternoon, Bob Keane came by for the planned meeting, but Bobby still hadn't arrived. Shortly before 3 p.m., the band called it quits and headed out, assuming Bobby wasn't going to be coming that day, and there was no point in rehearsing without their frontman. A few hours later, around 5 p.m., guitarist Jim Reese and drummer Dalton Powell, who had replaced Dwayne Kirico, decided to swing by Bobby's apartment to see what he was up to, find out why he didn't come to the session that morning. They also later said that Bobby had previously invited them over that day. According to both men, they pulled up to Bobby's apartment and noted that the blue Oldsmobile still was not there. The two men were walking up to Bobby's door at the same time that Lorraine was heading to check the mail out the back door. According to Lorraine, she noticed the blue Oldsmobile parked in the lot and immediately went over to see if Bobby had just pulled up. As she approached the vehicle, she noted the heavy scent of gasoline. Lorraine reached out and pulled the driver's side door open, and there she saw her son, Bobby Fuller, lying across the front seat with his hand still on the keys that were plugged into the ignition, though the vehicle was off. This is later contradicted by the autopsy report, which states that the keys were not found in the ignition. After trying to wake Bobby, Lorraine realized the horrible truth and immediately turned and ran back to the apartment to call the police. Hearing her hysterical screams, Jim and Dalton walked towards the car with trepidation and witnessed the same sight that had sent Lorraine screaming up the stairs. In shock, the two men mindlessly wandered back towards their car and drove off in a daze. Rick Stone arrived shortly thereafter, and as he pulled up, he noted several LAPD vehicles, and as he approached, police pushed him back and told him to step back from the scene, though Stone noted the sight of a 2.5-gallon gas can lying on the floorboard with a tube running up from it. Bobby's head was partially under the steering wheel, and his hair was greasy, his clothing was wet, and it was clear by the scene and the smell that Bobby was soaked in gasoline. Initially, there was no determination made by investigators as to a cause of death. The scene became even more bizarre when other details were noted in official reports. Aside from Bobby having been soaked in gasoline, it was said that his arms and torso were covered in bruises, and it would later be determined that the car Bobby had been found in was parked in that spot for approximately 30 minutes prior to Lorraine discovering him. Bob Keen, who had arrived on the scene after Lorraine's discovery but before the arrival of police, noted that as he tried to lift Bobby's head, his body was stiff, suggesting that he'd been dead for several hours. The details about the car were strange, as both Jim and Dalton stated multiple times the vehicle was not there when they arrived minutes before Lorraine saw it. How could Bobby have been dead for hours, but parked in the car for only 30 minutes? And how did Jim and Dalton completely miss the car? These are questions for which there have never been sufficient answers. Bobby was taken to the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner's Office, wherein an autopsy was conducted by Jerry Nelson that same day. The report checks both of the boxes for suicide and accidental death, while Bobby's death certificate noted the cause of death as asphyxia due to the inhalation of gasoline, though later, in the month of October, this would be changed to accidental asphyxiation. Interestingly, in the autopsy report, the bruising on Bobby's body is clarified as not actually being bruising, but multiple petechial hemorrhages believed to have been caused by the combination of his skin being soaked in gasoline and the heat of the sun reacting with that gasoline. The coroner noted no signs of physical abuse, no broken bones, and no cuts or abrasions. Interestingly, both Rick and Lorraine would later argue against this, saying that they saw abrasions. Rick as well noted seeing dried blood on Bobby's shirt, though this is not mentioned anywhere in the autopsy report. Toxicology showed no poisons, barbiturates, or even alcohol in his system. Dean Quippers, in an article for Spin Magazine, added, quote, "Bobby's bladder, however, had been full, which seemed to indicate that he'd been unconscious for a long time before he died," end quote. Now, you might be inclined to ask, how can there be so many unanswered questions floating around the death of a major celebrity and no official answers from the LAPD? Well, the answer to that riddle is that the LAPD didn't conduct much of an investigation. Within hours of Bobby's death, local papers and then national news reported that he had died as the result of a suicide, even before the autopsy itself had been conducted. In what can only be attributed to either laziness, complicity, or just a general failure to properly investigate, the police didn't do very much digging to determine if suicide was the most likely cause of death. You'd imagine, considering the odd details of how his body was found, you might want to ask a few questions, but that doesn't happen here. The LAPD actually performed several acts which ensure that future investigations would be inhibited and that any attempts to prove an alternative theory is nearly impossible. It's unlikely this was the result of a purposeful disruption of evidence, and more likely the result of negligence, but some disagree. Firstly, the LAPD never dusted the car for prints nor swept it for any forensics, turning it back over to the family without checking the car for any signs that someone other than Bobby may have been in the vehicle or had been driving the vehicle that day. Interestingly, the autopsy report says that Bobby's body was found in a full state of rigor mortis, meaning that Bobby had likely been dead for at least 2 hours prior to being found, and yet the vehicle was supposedly only parked there for 30 minutes. If Jim and Dalton were correct in saying that the car was not there when they arrived, then the vehicle had to have been driven by someone else, since Bobby couldn't have pulled in after them if he was already dead. Unfortunately, whether or not someone else was in the car or had driven it that day is a mystery we'll never know the answer to. In the highly debated death of another musician just shy of 30 years later, Kurt Cobain, his death was ultimately ruled a suicide, and yet to this day, more than 30 years after, the Seattle Police Department has the shotgun in their evidence lockup. So what did the LAPD do with the gas can that was allegedly the cause of Bobby's death? Well, they put it in the trash. Not even the trash at the station or in the evidence room, but a trash can at the apartment complex. The can was never checked for prints, and so whether or not Bobby Fuller ever laid his hands on that can remains unknown. All of this is exceedingly frustrating, especially when you consider that months later his death would be changed to accidental, which seems to partially close the door on a confirmed suicide, opening the door to other possibilities. But where do you go when you don't have the evidence to work with? In the aftermath of Bobby's death, several rumors came to the surface. One indicated a woman named Melanie, who Bobby was either friends with or perhaps was having a physical relationship with. I should note in some places this woman is called Melody, though most sources say Melanie. It's difficult to know the correct name as this woman has never popped up to discuss Bobby or his death since it happened. This Melanie was allegedly connected to a man in the area who was well known to be connected to organized crime. It was supposed at the time that this man may not have appreciated Bobby spending time with his girlfriend, and that he may have sought revenge, especially if Melanie was the woman Bobby spoke to on the phone that night. In further contradictions, Rick would later say that when the family received Bobby's personal effects, including the clothing he wore the day he died, he had on bedroom slippers, and the toes of those slippers were very scraped up, which he believed indicated that Bobby had been dragged across gravel or rocks. There was also several witnesses to the scene who later claimed that one of Bobby's fingers appeared to have been broken, as if it had been bent backwards, but the coroner reported no broken bones. Curiously, despite all of these discrepancies and the curious nature of the death itself, the LAPD later told the media that there was no evidence of foul play and that this case was closed and sealed. Rick, however, wasn't the only one who had information that contradicted the official report. Jim Reese, the guitarist, alleged that when he arrived on the scene and saw Bobby in the car, he noted a partially burned book of matches in the back seat, which he believed indicated that someone had attempted to set the car on fire, but either failed to do so or fled when people came around the parking lot. In hopes of gathering further information and to track down possible leads about who may have wanted Bobby dead and who could have been involved, two different private investigators were hired at different times. In the middle of their investigations, though, both men would walk away from the case. One private investigator simply quit without giving notice or a reason why. The other left town, although he allegedly told Rick Stone that he'd been threatened and was in fear for his life. Jim Reese later claimed that, just days after Bobby's death, three men arrived at his apartment looking for him, and they were armed. Reese fled to El Paso in fear for his life. In terms of motive, some believe there could be a connection to Bobby's recording contract. While the singer had made it clear he wanted out of this deal, it's important to note that the record company had taken life insurance policies out on all members of the band. While Randy Fuller's life insurance was $150,000, Bobby was insured for $850,000. For the record, adjusted for inflation in 2019, $850,000 would today be $6.7 million. We know that part of Bobby's contract was tied to Morris Levy and Roulette Records. If Bobby did walk away or get out of his contract, this would have cost them quite a bit, and Levy was rumored not to be the type to just let someone go free. It's rare that anyone associated with the mafia is just going to let you walk away, star or not, without getting something back from their investment. Some people believe that perhaps if Bobby couldn't get him paid off alive, he may have seen the life insurance policy and realized that the singer was worth much more money dead. There were also rumors at the time that Bobby may have been experimenting with LSD, and some have tried to make a connection between the death of Bobby Fuller and a party he could have attended where things just went wrong. There are some who believe the scene of his death was staged to cover up an accident, and it's interesting to note that before the coroner could test Bobby for LSD, he ran out of samples to test, and Bobby, by this time, had already been embalmed. There are also some who try to connect Bobby and LSD to Charles Manson, and believe that he could have been targeted by the Manson family, though for most, the timeline doesn't match up, and Bobby doesn't seem to fit into their style of murder. Bobby Fuller was laid to rest on July 20, 1966, and interred at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in the Hollywood Hills. His stone simply reads, Robert G. Fuller, Beloved Son. Bobby's father, Lawson, passed away in 1988 at the age of 86, while his mother, Lorraine, followed the next year, dying in 1989 at the age of 79. Both Lawson and Lorraine went to their graves never believing that Bobby would have taken his own life. Randy, alive today at 75 years old, continued on in the music industry following Bobby's death, though it was never quite the same. For a time, he tried to lead the band, renamed to the Randy Fuller Four, but as several bandmates commented, it was difficult to go on when Bobby had been the heart and soul of that group. In 2015, Randy was a key consultant and collaborator on Miriam Lena's book about Bobby, his death, and the band. Randy remains the last surviving member of the Fuller family, and to this day holds strong beliefs that Bobby would never have taken his life and was likely murdered. What happened to Bobby Fuller? For that question, there's no shortage of rumors and speculation. Many of the theories fit into one of three separate possible categories. The first theory argues that Bobby Fuller, frustrated with his situation and feeling overwhelmed by the pressure of the industry, as well as feeling trapped, made the choice to take his own life in what can only be described as a very strange method for suicide. The second theory follows somewhat along those lines, though ultimately determines that Bobby's death was the result of an accident. Some have argued that Bobby at the time could have been on LSD and may have been hallucinating, which could have led to him putting gasoline all over himself, which led to asphyxia. The third theory, and the one which most people argue for, is that Bobby Fuller was murdered. In terms of a motive for that murder, the list includes revenge from a mob associate who felt Fuller was too friendly with his girlfriend, a mafia-connected record producer who didn't want to lose his contract with Bobby and decided to cash in on his valuable life insurance policy, and some have even tried to apply Bobby's death to Charles Manson. There are those who believe it could have been a random murder, though given the circumstances and the location Bobby was found in, that doesn't make a great deal of sense. Bobby Fuller was an incredibly talented musician whose work continues to maintain radio play some 53 years after his untimely death. He was a son, brother, and friend. His music was but one extension of a truly talented and caring person. While rumor and speculation run rampant around the deaths of many celebrities, few involve details as bizarre and contradictory as those which came out about Bobby in the months and years after his death. Buddy Holly, Bobby's hero, died in the midst of his fame at the young age of 22, and Bobby made it just 1 year older, losing his life at the age of 23, also at the height of his stardom. In a rare 2016 interview with ClassicBands.com, Randy Fuller was asked whether, 50 years later, they were any closer to finding an answer. He replied, quote, "No, I don't think so. Unless somebody admits to it, I don't think we're ever going to solve it. I've got my hopes up still. I still hope that somebody will say the right thing. I pray every day that someone will just all of a sudden come out of nowhere and say, yeah, I did it. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen after 50 years. The death of Bobby Fuller is one of those bizarre cases that if you told it to someone in casual conversation, they'd think it was too unrealistic to be true. A popular musician rising to fame with big plans for his future apparently gets into his mother's car, drives around for a while, eventually returns to his apartment, rolls up the windows of the car, pours gasoline all over himself, and dies due to inhaling the fumes. Now, there have been more bizarre suicides throughout history, though there are certain details of this one that make you wonder whether or not it actually was a suicide. I suppose that's why we're here, and why over 50 years later, people are still trying to figure out what exactly happened to Bobby Fuller. This is definitely a case which has been controversial over the years and has disappeared and reappeared in media coverage, usually around specific anniversaries of Bobby's death. The most recent swell of coverage came between 2015 and 2016, as we approach the 50-year mark of the day that Bobby died. In 2015, Randy collaborated on a book where he, for the first time, gave a lot of detailed information about his brother, the band, and his brother's death. For the most part, people close to Bobby and who were around in the days before and after his death have remained fairly quiet, avoiding interviews about the topic. Many have expressed being afraid to mention certain names, noting that some of those names were still out there and dangerous. One last note before jumping into the theories here. I'm a fan of Bobby Fuller. I have a bunch of his songs on my streaming devices. I listen to them often. There's a part of me that will always wonder what could have become of Bobby Fuller had he lived, which is something we always think about when artists are gone before their time. I worked pretty hard in the writing of this episode to try and remain in the middle, without leaning into bias one way or the other, but I do acknowledge there's a possibility I may have spoken about certain issues a little more passionately than I would have were it another case. But in a case like this, with so many bizarre details, it's difficult not to get caught up in that emotion. But let's move into the theories. So, the first theory in this case is the official listing, that Bobby Fuller died as the result of a suicide. Well, I guess that's not 100% accurate, since the medical examiner also checked the accident box, and the death certificate was later changed to show it may have been an accidental death. But for most people, when they look at this, they consider that a suicide. So, suicide is obviously a very complicated issue, and it's tied to a lot of emotional, mental illness, substance abuse issues, personal experiences. It's really hard to get into the headspace of someone who's going to commit suicide unless you've been in that headspace before, but we're going to try to give it a shot. Depression is typically the leading factor in someone's choice to commit suicide. As we become more aware of how depression works, the symptoms of depression and the behaviors of those who are depressed, there's more of an ability to intervene before the person can take that step. But plenty of people today succeed at suicide without anyone in their lives knowing it was a possibility. Imagine it's 1966, back when seeing a therapist was stigmatized. People got good at hiding things, and most people didn't ask questions as it wasn't considered polite to stick your nose in. So the question becomes, was Bobby Fuller suffering from depression? We can't know that answer, but the possibility exists. I can't imagine the pressures you'd feel as a rising musical star in the mid-1960s, especially if you're unhappy with the way your contract is laid out. I certainly can't dismiss the idea that Bobby could have had depression for years before and that it became exacerbated by that situation. We've seen a lot of celebrities end their lives over the years, and especially in the music industry, when you look at names like Chris Cornell, Chester Bennington, Ian Curtis, and Donny Hathaway. Then you've got musicians whose deaths have been attributed to suicide, but many argue against that, such as Kurt Cobain and Elliott Smith. Of course, suicide has been involved in all angles of the entertainment industry, from music to film and everything in between. How many famous authors or poets have taken their own lives? For a lot of people, they look at these celebrities and assume that they must have it all. So how could they commit suicide? The fact of the matter is, if you're suffering from depression and you're not medicated or in therapy or both, no amount of money, no amount of love, no amount of adulation from your fans is going to fill that emptiness you feel inside. I personally live with a diagnosis of major depressive disorder, and this is something that I've lived with for so long in my life, I've been living with it before I even knew what depression was. I'm not saying that gives me any special insight into anyone else, but it does give me a better understanding of what it's like to deal with depression on a daily basis. No one in Bobby's life thought he was suicidal. That doesn't necessarily mean that he wasn't, although when you look at his life, all of the things that he did, how driven he appeared to be, if he was depressed, it certainly didn't hamper his drive. One interesting aspect to look at with the suicide was mentioned by Randy himself. Lorraine had been devastated when her first son, Jack, was murdered. The loss of a child, as most parents will agree, destroys the parent, and it's not something you ever forget. Both Randy and Bobby saw how it affected Lorraine, and it does seem a little strange that were Bobby suicidal, he'd elect to take his life on a weekend when his mother was visiting. He would have known how much his death would hurt her, let alone doing it in her car a 2-minute walk from the apartment she was staying in. I tried to pull statistics about suicides that involve the inhalation of gasoline, but believe it or not, that's actually hard to find. I did find some studies revolving around people who had committed suicide by inhaling natural gas, though most of these involved either placing a bag over the head in addition to turning on the gas, or turning on the gas in the home and then going to sleep. We do have some examples involving ovens, such as Sylvia Plath's suicide, but I couldn't find anywhere someone who committed suicide by pouring gasoline on themselves in a car. That doesn't mean it couldn't have happened that way, just that it's certainly an outlier in terms of suicide statistics. I did find a lot of reports about suicide using gasoline for an intravenous injection. Gasoline fumes are toxic to breathe and can cause all manner of symptoms. Usually when someone dies from inhaling gasoline, it's because of carbon monoxide poisoning. Most discussions of that say that prolonged exposure to carbon monoxide, in this case caused by gasoline, will lead to a loss of consciousness followed by death. I don't know if sitting in a car with gasoline all over yourself for 30 minutes is long enough to lose consciousness, but again, it's kind of difficult to find statistics on something this specific. Ultimately, the inhalation of gasoline can absolutely cause death, and it's entirely possible that Bobby Fuller got into the car, closed the doors, rolled up the windows, and poured gas on himself to commit suicide. There is the curious issue of the car doors. They weren't locked. Now, maybe Bobby forgot, but if someone had found him earlier, they could have opened the door and pulled him out, eliminating suicide as a possibility. So it's interesting that he wouldn't have locked the doors. Most people who commit suicide in cars do the old hose in the exhaust pipe, then into the car, and go straight for the carbon monoxide poisoning directly. Interestingly, Randy claimed in a later interview that Bobby also hated the smell of gasoline. I do want to note, I have read accounts where they say the roof of Bobby's car was rolled down when he was found, but I can't verify that. It would seem somewhat contrary to the inhalation findings if the convertible roof was down when he was found, and in almost all accounts that is not stated, so I don't think it's true. It could be a question, though, of whether or not the death was accidental, which takes us to the second theory. Under the accident theory, there's a couple of different angles. There's the general accident theory that Bobby spilled gasoline on himself somehow, was in the car and decided to drive back to the apartment without rolling down the windows, and died shortly after arriving due to exposure to the fumes. That, of course, contradicts the autopsy and eyewitness accounts that Bobby was in full rigor mortis and had obviously been dead for a couple of hours at least. Not to mention, this accident angle lacks any kind of logic or common sense. Bobby wasn't a stupid man, and if he somehow spilled gas on himself, I don't think he'd decide to drive with the windows up with the gas can on the floorboards. That I can't buy at all. So, for most people, the accident theory has to be connected to some kind of intoxication, whether it was alcohol or drugs. Most people believe Bobby would have had to have been out of it to have accidentally died this way. There's also the possibility that Bobby could have been huffing the fumes to get high, although why he'd continue doing this with gasoline spilled all over his clothing is bizarre. People huff gas, it happens, and they get a little high, although it's obviously incredibly dangerous. The thing about Bobby was that there are rumors that towards the end, he was experimenting with LSD. Prior to that, he just drank a bit and may have smoked weed from time to time. It's a large leap from marijuana to LSD. But it was a time when LSD was everywhere. So it's not unlikely for him to have attended a party or gone to a friend's house and been offered LSD. It seems a little less likely that he was a gas huffer, as no one had ever seen him do it before. So, probably your best bet for an accident here is that Bobby was on something. Now, we know from toxicology he wasn't on any barbiturates, and though he had been drinking the night before, they didn't find any alcohol in his blood, which is kind of strange. Tests for alcohol in the blood are more accurate within 6 to 12 hours of drinking, and are probably a lot more accurate today than they were in 1966. The last confirmed drink we know of took place at 3 a.m., and Bobby's body was found around 5 p.m., which would be 14 hours later. So it's possible, especially if he wasn't drinking that much, that no alcohol was in his system by that time. I think that rules out the possibility that he died by accident due to being drunk. That really just leaves us to go down the LSD road, since it's a drug he was allegedly experimenting with and it wasn't tested for during his autopsy. LSD is an extremely powerful hallucinogen, which is most potent to a user in the beginning. Subsequent uses can create somewhat of a tolerance, though typically it doesn't stop the effects, but it may lessen them. If Bobby were just getting involved, it's unlikely he'd have much of a tolerance, if any at all. LSD, aside from causing hallucinations, can have a ton of adverse side effects, including the onset of psychosis and various other mental health issues. So the idea that Bobby, hallucinating on LSD, could have poured gasoline all over himself and died as a result of a trip is completely possible. People on LSD often see and experience things that are not actually there and not actually happening. It's impossible to imagine what could have or would have gone through Bobby's mind were he on LSD at that time. While we may look at pouring gasoline all over yourself as extreme, if he were hallucinating, say, that he was on fire, and hallucinated that the gas was water, I don't know. It's possible is really all I can say. Yeah, if Bobby was super out of it and tripping heavily, I might be able to buy that he accidentally died due to the inhalation of gasoline. For me, the problem really comes from his location. If the man was hallucinating enough to pour gasoline on himself and then sit there until he passed out, eventually dying, how the hell did he drive himself home? I guess he could have been driven home and then taken the LSD, but that calls into question the timing with him apparently having been dead for hours before he was found. Really nothing about this makes any sense. While the accident theory is there and is listed on his death certificate, most of the angles you could possibly approach this from don't make much sense. Some people have considered the possibility that Bobby could have taken LSD or some other substance at a party and something went wrong and he died. The people at the party could have freaked, loaded him into his car, driven him to his apartment, poured gas all over him, and fled the scene. Maybe if someone had dusted for prints, we'd know if this was more or less of a possibility. Here's the issue, though. If that happened, how would Bobby's cause of death be ruled due to inhalation of gasoline? Maybe in 1966, they didn't have a way to determine if he had inhaled the gas versus something else, and just given the nature of his body and the scene as they found it with the can being there, they just assumed? I honestly don't know, but considering the shoddy work on this investigation, I can't rule out the idea that they simply didn't look hard enough for a cause of death. If it wasn't suicide, and it wasn't an accident, what else could it have been? Most people tend to think this was a murder. Now, when you're looking at murder, you've got to find a motive. We've got a handful of motives to work with, so we'll start from the bottom and work our way to the top. For me, the bottom begins with the so-called Melanie. Rick Stone would later tell people that Melanie was a friend of Bobby's that worked in a bar nearby his apartment. He claims that Bobby spoke to her on the phone the night before he died. Now, Melanie was supposedly dating some guy who most people believe was dangerous, possibly connected to the mafia, and maybe powerful in the industry. Specifics are difficult to ascertain as no one has ever really gone into too much detail about this guy. Either way, it's certainly possible this guy could have disliked Bobby and wanted to teach him a lesson. Whether or not Melanie was involved in luring Bobby out for this purpose, we simply don't know, but it doesn't have to have been that sinister. Bobby speaks to Melanie, goes out to meet her, ends up at her place, and then in walks her boyfriend wanting some answers. I could see that happening. Now, what would have caused Bobby to die is unknown. There is the detail about his bladder where it was so full some have speculated he was unconscious for a while before he died. I don't really understand that, but it's been noted in a couple of locations. You have Rick Stone saying that he saw dried blood on Bobby's shirt, though this isn't stated in any official report. So yeah, the guy could have knocked Bobby over the head or maybe even choked him until he passed out. Maybe he didn't plan to kill him, but it went too far and he had to act fast. So the plan was to cover him in gasoline, leave him in his car, and see what happens. Maybe they didn't even think people would call it a suicide, but they probably assumed they wouldn't be suspects. It's hard to say. Jim Reese claimed that he saw a partially burned book of matches in the backseat of the car. So maybe the plan was to set the car and Bobby on fire to cover up the crime that actually led to his death, but that didn't work out, or someone was coming, or whatever happened to cause the fire not to be set. A fire certainly would have covered things up a lot more, though the idea of a suicide may not have been such an easy conclusion for investigators to leap to had a fire actually been set. Whatever way you slice it, this could have happened with any of the theories, so let's just agree to something. Rather than me repeating myself about all this stuff with the car and the gas and the fire and the driving it and leaving it there and staging the scene, we'll just assume that for all the murder angles we're going to discuss, there's a likelihood that whoever committed the murder staged the scene as it was found. Next, I wanted to address the Charles Manson angle quickly because I've seen it around, and for the most part people dismiss it, but there are some who are very convinced that Manson played a role in Bobby's death. So the basics behind this vary a bit depending where you look, but it tends to go like this. Charles Manson approaches Bobby Fuller and asks for guitar lessons. Bobby says no, so Manson wants to kill him. Angry, Manson allegedly doses Bobby with LSD without his consent and then set forth to murdering him, going far enough to stage the bizarre scene that was found when Bobby's body was discovered. There's a couple problems with this, but the most major seems to be that Charles Manson was in prison at the time Bobby Fuller died. In 1960, Manson was sent to prison for violating his probation related to a previous arrest for cashing forged checks. Manson fought against this charge for a year, but it was to no avail and he was ordered to serve out a 10-year sentence. His official release date from this sentence was March 21st, 1967. Some 8 months after Bobby Fuller's death. That seems to pretty tightly close the lid on the Manson possibility. Now, I know some people will argue that Manson could have had someone commit this crime for him, but he started serving his sentence in 1960. He probably wouldn't have known who Bobby Fuller was for at least 3 or 4 years. He didn't even form the Manson family until after this sentence, so while he could have been in touch with people willing to kill for him back in 1966, the idea that Bobby Fuller would have been a target doesn't really seem to have any validity to it. So that pretty much leaves us with what has become the most popular angle of the murder theory, that Bobby's death could have been connected to his record contract, Morris Levy, and organized crime. Levy owned multiple record companies, record stores, and even the factories that manufactured records themselves. You ever watch The Sopranos? There was a character on there named Hesh. Well, according to the Huffington Post, that character was based on Morris Levy. Anyway, this guy was tied into major East Coast organized crime families, and from every account I've seen, people did not want to mess with him. He had a reputation for being a dangerous man who didn't play games and didn't like to lose. Back then, record labels had a history of signing young, up-and-coming artists to deals that ultimately put money in the pockets of the business and little in the hands of the actual talent, buying the copyrights to songs, publishing rights, everything. Tom Petty famously had such a major dispute over what he believed was an unfair contract that he refused to release his third album until he was given a new contract. So the idea that Bobby was unhappy with his record contract isn't exactly surprising. Bobby had done almost everything himself up to that point in his life, creating his own recording studio, getting albums pressed and played on his own. He would certainly have been angry if his money was being taken and the rights to his music weren't his anymore. Any artist would have been upset about that, but most of them wouldn't have fought against a man like Morris Levy. People often throw Bob Keane into this mix, and I don't know the character of Bob Keane, but if he was in business with Morris Levy, then it's probably safe to assume he at least knew what kind of a man Levy was, and it was Keane who cut the deal with Levy in regard to Bobby Fuller. So imagine a man like Morris Levy, who takes on this contract, spends money on promotion and to get records pressed and whatever the hell else he did, but he's got Bobby locked into a contract, and whether the young musician wants it or not, he's gonna keep working until that contract is fulfilled. Well, Bobby, maybe naive about the situation or not caring, decided to hell with it. He's not going to play. He's not going to keep working for someone who's screwing him over. So he starts talking about walking away, leaving his contract behind, leaving Levy shortchanged. So maybe Keane tries to talk some sense into him, but Bobby isn't having it. Then Levy gets involved or calls in some friends to convince Bobby to stick with the contract. We don't know exactly where Bobby went the night before he died, but it isn't impossible that he was confronted by some not-so-nice guys who told him he needed to stick with his contract, and when he refused, he became more valuable dead than alive. Now, I'm condensing a lot of possibilities there, and who knows what way it could have actually went down, but it's not impossible to imagine. A corrupt and violent criminal like Morris Levy can either keep Bobby Fuller under contract and force him to do things, or they may end up in court where Bobby will be legally compelled to honor his contract, or he could actually win, or Levy can actually just have him eliminated and cash in on his $850,000 life insurance policy. Usually, guys who are connected to the mob aren't big on negotiating unless they've got a gun to your head, so there's always the possibility that Levy had Bobby killed just to eliminate the headache he'd have to deal with otherwise and to get his money back, and then some. It would also send a message to any other rebellious artist what happens when you mess with Morris Levy. And let's face it, we're talking about an investigation, if you want to call it that, headed up by the LAPD, not exactly an organization known for their purity in this era, let alone others. Could someone with the power, money, and pull of Levy have influenced over the LAPD in 1966? Yeah. I'm not saying that the LAPD was involved in this, but let's face it, it's not exactly outside of the realm of possibility. When you put everything side by side and you start eliminating possibilities, it's hard to ignore the murder aspect. Suicide? Sure, it's a possibility, but it's incredibly bizarre and one of the most strange suicides I've ever seen. You have the possibility of an accident, maybe drug-fueled, and that seems a little more likely than a suicide does, although a lot of the details of how the accident occurred are missing and are difficult to really wrap your head around. Then you've got murder. Someone kills Bobby, stages the scene, and walks away scot-free. If you have to decide, which do you think is the most likely? Let me put it another way. Occam's razor says that the simplest explanation is usually the most likely. Which of these three is the most simple explanation? That Bobby Fuller killed himself at the height of his stardom in a car by pouring gasoline all over himself and somehow ended up back at his apartment's parking lot 30 minutes before he was found but dead for several hours. Or that Bobby was tripping hard on LSD, hallucinated, poured gas on himself, died as a result of the fumes, and then somehow ended up back at his apartment in the car, again, dead for hours but only there for 30 minutes. Or that someone, for some reason, murdered Bobby Fuller and staged the scene. I know my answer. We'll never know what Bobby Fuller could have been or what he would have produced musically had he lived. His family never got to see him get married, have a family, build a future, whatever it is he may have wanted to do. Bobby Fuller's life ended under incredibly bizarre circumstances, and 53 years later, we're no closer to understanding the truth than we were the day it happened. Like his brother Randy said, I don't see the vast wealth of questions floating around this case getting answered unless someone confesses. Beyond that, the LAPD consider this case closed, but music fans around the world continue to disagree and search for justice. If you're looking for more information about the life and death of Bobby Fuller, there are many articles, forums, and websites dedicated to all aspects of his story. The 2015 book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller, was a collaboration by Miriam Lena and Randy Fuller. Also, Broken Melody, The Bobby Fuller Story, is a fantastic series of articles written by Edna Gunderson for the El Paso Times. Normally, at this point, I'd say, if you have any information about the death of Bobby Fuller, please contact the LAPD, but I don't know if they would even look at it. So, if you have any information about the death of Bobby Fuller, contact the FBI, or perhaps try to get in touch with Randy Fuller. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. Special shout out to Patreon producers Emily Smith, Megan Cotter, Kate Alexander, Chandra Moreau, Jacob Williams, Brian Kemmerling, Wannabe Sleuth 2, Laura Dixon, Julia Rexon, Diane Dyson, Jessica, Tom Archer, Eamon Brady, Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Randy Weiland, and Megan. You are all absolutely amazing. I want to thank everyone for listening. I look forward to hearing your thoughts on this case, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.